So I received a DM this week from somebody that listens to the show, and they had heard me talking about how I use Raycast and finally downloaded it for themselves. And all the DM said was, "This is going to completely change the way that I use my computer, isn't it?" And it's true. Once you realize how much Raycast streamlines the way you work and just how easy it makes it to stay in flow, you can't really go back. Like, I use it for clipboard history, it's my portal to AI, window management, it's how I search for Figma files. So if you're still on the sidelines, I can't recommend Raycast enough. Head to dive.club/raycast to get started. That's R-A-Y-C-A-S-T. Okay, now on to the episode.
You only need one person to see it and they're like, "Oh, okay, I like this." And it might lead to some random opportunity. One of my biggest clients was from a billion-dollar company. And I asked him, you know, why did you hire me? And he showed me this piece of work that I uploaded to Dribbble. And I just was like, "Oh, that's not even my best work." But clearly they liked it. At the end of the day, it's like marketing, isn't it? You are marketing yourself when you share stuff online. And it's a good way to increase your own luck.
Welcome to Dive Club. My name is Rid, and this is where designers never stop learning. This week's episode is with Ollier, who's a designer and creator. And today he's going to give a masterclass about what it takes to effectively put yourself out there online and how to approach personal branding as a designer. Now, investing in this set of skills has been one of the best decisions that I've made from my career. So I wanted to find the perfect person to talk to, and I think that it's Ollier. Now, he's used design and his own personal aesthetic to amass an audience of hundreds of thousands and build a really interesting portfolio of projects that have allowed him to never work a W-2 role in his life. But what makes his story particularly fascinating is that it truly started at zero.
I was in school and I was studying like business and accounting. At the time, I thought to myself, like, okay, I'm like 17, 18, 19, around that sort of age. And I kind of realized, because my parents didn't have any money, they had nothing. Like, they didn't have, I couldn't rely on them for money, and I wouldn't rely on them for money. So I kind of thought to myself, I'm really on my own here. Like, I've got to figure this out. And I don't want to live how my parents lived, how they grew up. So I've got to do something different. And I remember I liked anything to do with computers and the internet and all these different things. But I definitely didn't know you could make money from the internet. Like, I just didn't know that was a thing. At the time, I had an Android phone and I would customize it. What I would do is I would take the app, the APK file, load it onto my computer, and I would literally modify the design files in there within Photoshop. Stuff like that, like very geeky, nerdy stuff, which at the time, obviously, I'm kind of just experimenting. And I remember, like, my Android phone had some icons in it, which I had designed myself, put those icons up. And that was the first experience of making money online. It seemed imaginary to me, like it didn't seem real at all. And from there on, I kind of just realized, okay, this is an interesting way to make money. But even then, I still didn't take it seriously. Because I thought to myself, okay, if I want to make serious money, I have to learn how to design, UI design, web design, make websites, and then sell those services to clients. So those following years, I actually built up my design skills and stuff like that, especially on Dribbble. Dribbble was like the gateway for me for learning design and seeing what works, seeing what's popular, seeing what people like. And that really helped propel my design skills, career, everything, all because of that weird period of like customizing my phone, messing around with my phone, learning how to make websites, sharing that stuff online, and then going on Dribbble and continuously just iterating on my design skills. But yeah, my background is very much just like starting from absolutely nothing. Like, I remember when I first started, actually, I was using the shared laptop in the house. So I could only work on the laptop like a few hours a day. So I had to be very productive with those hours.
It's interesting to look at where you're at now. And when I kind of even look at your portfolio, the things that you have going for you, I see a lot of long-term investments, things that you've contributed to over quite a significant period of time, things that don't happen overnight necessarily.
And what are you looking at in particular when you say like long-term investments like that?
Anything related to content, I think, takes a long time. Like, yes. I look at your YouTube, anytime you have six-figure followings, unless you have this truly viral moment, which I don't actually think is as easy to translate into long-term success anyway.
I agree.
When I look at your channels, the amount of distribution that you put into it, even probably the amount of inbound traffic on your websites and the things that, you know, you had the e-commerce business. Those things just don't happen overnight. Would you agree?
Yeah. I think I understood from a young age, I was in like early 20s, I'd say, that I've got to use leverage to scale. I can't just sell my time doing client work. I was doing client work at the time because obviously I didn't have any other income. So like I knew client work was a very, very good, quick income and like a great income as well. But I knew at the same time, this isn't what I want to do. I don't want to do client work all the time. Yeah. Even though I'd say I enjoyed a good percentage of my projects, the projects that I did, but I still just didn't like this idea of, okay, I'm selling my time on like a weekly basis or like a daily basis or something like that, because it didn't give me the freedom that I wanted. That really is the most important thing, that when I think back and I look at why am I doing this, it's because I want the freedom to be able to work on whatever I want to work on, to be able to have my own schedule. You know, if I want to spend a day just not working on something and just chill playing video games, I can do that and it's not really going to impact the business. Mm-hmm. I very much realized I needed to do things that are scalable, and content is scalable. I can put the same amount of work in now and the video might get 100,000 views. However, I can put the same amount of work in a year or two later and the video might get 1 million views. The output hasn't changed, but the audience is scaled. I don't know anything else that like that. I don't know anything else that has that much power. And it's why I like to do content, because I know it can lead to other opportunities as well quite easily.
It's interesting to hear you use the word leverage, because that was my moment as well. Mm. I remember I was on a hike with a friend. We were climbing this thing called the incline, which is like basically a mile straight up in Colorado. Okay. And we're going on this walk, and it was the moment that I first articulated this desire to apply some leverage to my time. I had the same kind of moment where I was like, I want to stop selling my time for money. I don't know what it looks like, but I am committed to figuring out a path to stop building wealth linearly by tying it to my time.
Naval Ravikant, he mentions that a lot, using leverage. Like, you shouldn't be chasing money or status. You should be chasing wealth. You should be like investing and sort of building things rather than just selling your time. Obviously, there's nothing wrong if you think a 9-to-5 suits you and you want to do 9-to-5, you don't have to, and you don't want to worry about investing and sort of building your own business and stuff, then yes, please do a 9-to-5. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Just for me personally, I realized, I just don't want to sell my time on like this sort of linear sort of basis. I want to scale it as much as I possibly can.
There are two things that I saw you share that stood out to me that I want to talk about really quickly, which is you said consistency over everything and discipline over motivation. So with this understanding that, yeah, you want to get to this point where you do have leverage over your time, what were some of the things that you had to put in place in your life in order to get to the point where you are shipping and creating with this level of consistency?
It's funny, because when I look back at my work and like the stuff I do share, I actually am not as consistent as many people think. There might be days, there might be weeks like where I miss an upload or I miss sharing something. I'm very sporadic in like the way I share things, but I still share. I'm still always thinking about, okay, what's the next thing to share? And I'm naturally that type of person. I've realized some people have to really think about what content they're going to make next or what they're going to do next. And I'm very much thinking about, I kind of just do it. I'm like automated to do it. And I think that is where the discipline is. I've built that discipline into myself of like, this is what I've got to do, because I know that it's going to lead to something. Whether like it's a video or a tweet or a piece of work or whatever, it's going to do something. Like, someone's going to see it. And I think that also leads into like, you create your own luck, because you have all these touch points, you're sort of sharing all this stuff online. People continuously come across your stuff. It's almost like a brand, like the personal branding sort of thing. Like, people just end up seeing you come up more and they trust, oh, okay, this person is continuously sharing, then clearly they're doing something of value, I guess. But obviously everyone will see that differently.
I think there was a period where maybe I started off and I prioritized discipline over everything. Like, when I was first starting, I got up at 5 a.m. And for 1 hour before work, I would just work on things. I would tinker. I would do things in Figma, and I would like tweet whatever I came up with.
Yeah.
I don't do that anymore.
Like, I don't want. I don't that sounds want like that my worst of, nightmare. I don't know how to do that.
It sounds like my worst nightmare too. And I think maybe the shift has, and I'm curious if this resonates. Like, the shift that I've made is now, when I have inspiration, I try to act on the inspiration as fast as I possibly can.
Yeah.
Because that is the moment where it's going to feel like skating rather than trudging up a hill.
Yeah.
And I don't try to schedule things as much.
Yeah.
Does that resonate with the way that you think about your own output?
100%. Like, I think exactly the same. And again, I think that's like working in sprints. Like, when you have the idea, when the inspiration is there, and like, that is like the best time to act on it if you can, like right there and then, because, you know, a few days later or a few weeks later, you're not going to be as passionate about the idea. You're not going to be as interested in it. So yeah, I think I'm exactly the same. And there have been random pieces of content online that exactly, well, they happened because of that. And I think also sometimes those pieces of content are the ones that do the best, like, you know, because you haven't really planned them. They just happened because you felt like you wanted to do it right there and then.
That's also something that resonates with me. Is there an example that you have top of mind of something that you kind of just winged that really popped off?
Yeah, like the high income skills video on my Ollie Online channel. Again, like, you know, I just spent like an hour, 2 hours, literally from coming up with the idea to publishing like a ready video. You know, it only took me a couple of hours, and I kind of just uploaded it and I just forgot about it. And then, you know, now it's like one of the most popular videos on the channel. Another one, actually, now that I think about it, is on my tech channel. I have the iPhone camera settings. That was, again, another video where, like, I kind of just had the idea and I was like, oh, I love taking pictures with my iPhone. Let's just upload this, see what happens. I uploaded it in like April. So it wasn't even after the iPhone was released. It was well after, like 6-7 months later than after the iPhone was released. Yet that video has got over 1 million views. And not only that, that video has also made me quite a good income in terms of AdSense. It's made me income for my presets, my Lightroom presets. So, like, again, that's just a video I was just like, let's just do it, see what happens. And now it's actually become like a popular staple of my channel, because now I'm like, okay, I need to do this every year for every new iPhone, and it works every time.
It's so interesting because, I mean, I have a similar experience where a lot of the content that has moved the needle for me the most has just been this flippant, oh, there's an interesting connection here. Mm. Hit send, walk away. Where the times where I feel like I've spent the most on creating something that I, you know, learned, where I'm like, you know, I'm going to spend 6 hours. I'm going to do custom animations to explain this concept. Yeah. And then it, like, nobody sees it. Just absolute crickets.
But I think the main important thing is that you're still getting it out there. Sure, it might not go viral. It might not be seen by tens of thousands of people, whatever. But you only need one person or two people or just a few people to see it. And they're like, oh, okay, I like this. And it might lead to some random opportunity. Like, I think about some of my stuff that I completely forget about. And I ask, oh, you know, what video did you come across? Or what piece of work did you come across? And they tell me, and I'm like, I did not even think of that.
Hmm.
Especially when it goes to, like, to my client work. When I used to do client work, one of my biggest clients was from a $1 billion company. And I was just like, I asked him, you know, why did you hire me? And he showed me this piece of work that I uploaded to Dribbble, this specific piece of work that I uploaded to Dribbble. And I just was like, oh, that's not even my best work. But clearly they liked it. And it wasn't popular on Dribbble or anything. It was just a random piece of work. Yet it brought me that opportunity. So I think it can bring you random opportunities, even when you share the most random things.
A few roles ago, same exact thing. I was randomly exploring what it would look like to design a homeschool product. It's kind of like a topic that I care a lot about. And I was just mocking up some different interactions. And somebody that was working on this education platform saw one specific mock-up that I just randomly made over the course of, like, I don't know, 90 minutes, 2 hours on a weekend. And they sent me it and they're like, hey, we really like this. We'd like you to come and design this education product for us. And I put, like, no time into it. And so it's like the phrase that you used earlier that stood out to me was this idea of, like, creating your own luck or, like, increasing your luck surface area. And I think in many ways, like, both of us are kind of like a product of why that matters.
At the end of the day, it's like marketing, isn't it? You are marketing yourself when you share stuff online, and it's a good way to increase your own luck. And like most people say, like, designers aren't good at marketing themselves. Like, they're not good at sharing stuff online. And I think it's just because I think we all are quite precious of our own work, and we don't want to share it with random people. We don't want random judgment or whatever, which I can completely understand. Like, getting random judgment from someone you don't care about, like, or whatever, it can sometimes hurt. I think I like to think I'm used to it now, just because I get all sorts of comments every day. But I know if someone is new to the scene, new to sharing stuff online, oh, like, it can be painful.
If you were earlier in your journey, maybe you're specializing in web design or something like that, how would you think about sharing your work consistently in the absence of Dribbble today?
So I would do what I see now on Twitter. Twitter, I think, is one of the best places right now. You see people like James McDonald, and they're sharing work constantly. And you can tell they're busy. Like, they have projects coming in all the time. And it's all just because they're sharing. They're not even sharing full projects. They're just sharing like tidbits of like random the things they've designed, whether it's like a modal or a form or an icon or something. They're just constantly sharing. I think that's what I would do. I think Twitter, Instagram, constantly sharing your work is what I would do now if I was starting again. I probably would still upload on Dribbble as well, but I think the audience is much larger on Twitter and Instagram. There are a lot of business people who are on Twitter and Instagram. And if they see someone that regularly pops up on their timeline, they're much more likely to hire that person or reach out to that person and be like, hey, I'd like to hire you for a project. I'm exactly the same. I hire artists for my wallpaper packs. And some of my wallpaper packs, you know, they're literally, I can't design them. I can't come up with some of this stuff because I don't have the skills. Yet I'll hire someone who I've seen on my Twitter or my Instagram, and they've regularly shared their work. And I'm like, I need to work with this person to come up with something.
What about for someone who wants to go beyond just sharing the pixels and really wants to invest in, you know, distribution and audience, this type of leverage that we were talking about earlier? Because I do think, like, especially when we have to use words, designers can be really allergic to marketing and self-promotion. So maybe you could even talk about your own experience a little bit. When you're putting yourself out there and, you know, spending years, maybe subconsciously, but you're investing in building your personal brand, how do you effectively promote yourself without crossing that line of being too pushy or too salesy?
I think if you are sharing something that's valuable and that can actually someone can use in their day-to-day life or whatever, they can use to make their iPad or desktop look nicer or their photos look nicer, whatever it is, they're going to trust you in a way because you have this following. And I'm giving away information for free. I'm giving away learnings for free. I'm giving away experiences for free. I want to share this stuff anyway. And the way I can continue sharing it is by hopefully making money from it as well. You know, I can't do it for free forever. It's not sustainable. So I think it really depends on what you're trying to build, what you're trying to sell. I think if you're trying to get like design clients, I honestly don't know how you would do that with YouTube. Other than the only thing I can think of is sharing your design process on YouTube. But yeah. I actually don't think business owners care about your design process. They care about the end result. Because that whole reason they're hiring you is because they don't want to think about the job. They want the job done. Like, they're paying you so that they don't have to think about it. I think a lot of people overestimate their own process. The only people who are interested in your process, really, are other people who want to be like you.
I think I agree. I also think that we overestimate the amount that even hiring managers care about our process too. Yes, like somebody who's evaluating for a W-2 role, it's like, we just think that we have to check all these boxes of I did this, then I did this. And it's like, no, actually, if you took that time, maybe hit it with some bullet points, but if you invested in like a really slick animation and brought your work to life and had it move and really speak to the value of what the end product looks like, I'm like, I think most of the time that's probably a worthwhile investment.
All they care about is if you can get the job done, however you get the job done, that's all what matters. And of course, I also think it does very much matter on being a person that you can get along with. I think a lot of people don't realize how important that is to be likable. But that doesn't mean you have to change to be likable. You just have to be a nice person to be around, I think.
I couldn't agree more. And I actually think there's so much alpha in being kind in today's online designer sphere. If I had to give one piece of advice for someone who is looking to, you know, quote unquote, break in or make connections in the industry or maybe build a following, it's just to at least one time a day, if you come across somebody's work or some design somewhere and you like it, find that designer and send them a message saying, hey, I saw this thing that you made and it was so cool. Like, I thought this was really awesome. I just wanted to say, like, good work. You don't even have to ask anything. There's no ask. It's just be optimized for being kind. And if you do it over a long enough time horizon, I think there are real benefits.
Yeah. I do exactly what you just said, where, like, if I come across something on Twitter, for example, someone has made something or someone has shared something, a photo, piece of design work or a product they've made or whatever, and I think is cool, I will reply to them directly on Twitter, like publicly, and be like, oh, like, yo, this is amazing. Yo, this is sick. It's not as formal as having to DM them or message mm-hmm. them directly. And at the same time, for them, it's like public validation. Like, they're like, oh, you know, this random person has likes my stuff. It looks good for everyone all around, I think. Like, it looks good for you for sharing the feedback. It looks good for them because other people are sharing, liking their work. And also just makes you seem like a nice person. I think, like you said, like, just being a nice person can get you so much further. I would much rather work with someone I get along with who is maybe lacking a few skills than someone who's like amazing at what they do, but they're an absolutely awful person to be around, because the person who's lacking a few skills can learn those skills. But the person who's an awful person probably won't change.
And even though you have so many followers, I bet you have a short list of people that have consistently and kindly engaged with your stuff, where if they would send you a DM or an email or something like that and ask a question, you would be so quick to help them because have recognized the fact that they have been genuinely supportive over some kind of a longer time horizon.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I agree. There have been people who have done that where, like, I've known they followed my stuff for years. I don't expect them, obviously, to like and reply to everything I post. Like, that just doesn't make sense. But there are some people who, like, followers who I've become friends with, which is weird in its own way, but, like, I know they genuinely just like my stuff rather than they're kind of just trying to get something out of it.
All right. I want to return back to the marketing self-promotion question, because I'm not going to let you get out that easy.
Okay.
With saying free work or free value and, you know, that just makes it all okay. Because I think even within this end product of giving away something for free, there's a spectrum where on one hand, maybe you are just sharing a web design and it's just the pixels and there's no text. Or maybe in your case, when you're doing a lot more YouTube things, you know, right now you have these kind of classy, not clickbaity thumbnails, but there's a world where you're using really bright colors and making all these goofy faces and pointing at your iPhone. And, like, maybe that would increase click-throughs, but at what cost? And so there is this line that you're having to navigate as someone who is putting yourself out there on the internet of, like, how much cringe is good cringe and where do I not want to cross over? Same thing for me. I'm writing all the time. I'm putting out my articles and I could just tweet the link or I could say, like, 10 things you need to stop doing right now, you know, all caps. Yeah. How do you think about where that line exists or what amount of cringe is good cringe?
Everyone's cringe level is different. Everyone's cringe level is different. So I think the line is wherever you think the line is. Like, it's as simple as that. When I share something, I think to myself, do I find it cringe doing this? And if I find it cringe doing this, then that means it's not me. That isn't me. Like, that's not who I actually am. So I'm not being truthful and honest in the way I'm portraying myself online there.
Love that.
So I think everyone's cringe level is different. Some people clearly, like, you know, YouTube does like the idea and other places do like the idea of, like, you know, 10 things that this, that, and the other with some crazy thumbnail with your face, with a stupid face, whatever. Yeah, go for it. If that's what you want to do, go for it. I actually don't think there's anything wrong with it, because I think the people who are interested in that type of content is different from the people who I want to be interested in my type of content. I specifically am not looking to be the number one tech YouTuber. I just want to have my own circle somewhere else, my own niche that I want to build myself and that I want full control over and have a comfortable level of cringe. Because what I do, maybe I don't find cringy at all. Like, you know, maybe what I'm doing is completely normal, but other people might find it cringe. So at the end of the day, there isn't like a scorecard or a scoreboard for cringe because everyone is so different.
Okay, I've never heard someone say it like that. And I think you're really on to something where, yes, cringe is individualized and it is a feeling that comes from when you're acting outside of like who you actually are.
Mm.
That's pretty interesting.
My friend Ali Abdaal, obviously I'm sure you know who Ali is.
Definitely.
We've spoken about this before. He's also trying to figure out, like, we were talking about like cringe and like sharing stuff online. And he told me, why am I not more cringe?
Yeah.
And I was like, interesting. Why aren't I more cringe? Because he sometimes does stuff that's very cringe. And he's doing it on purpose. He's playing with the line. He's trying to figure out where the line is for him and where the line is with his audience. And he was telling me, why am I not more cringe? Why don't I do more of the wacky stuff? Why don't I do the crazy thumbnails and stuff like that? And I think it is just purely down to like, that's not me. That's just not me. And I'm hoping the people who I attract, who follow me, stuff like that, also have the same sort of level. Otherwise, I don't think they would follow me. They would be following people on YouTube who do the crazy thumbnails and the crazy titles and this over-enthusiastic personality. That's just not who I am. That's just not me.
I have similar people in a Slack group that I'm in that often say the same kind of thing to me, where it's like, hey, if you just like wrote your hook on LinkedIn this way, a little bit more attention grabbing. And it's like, I know that would work. I don't disagree that would work. It's also like, there is this element of embracing the cringe. And I think especially for people that are listening to this that haven't actually built a habit of putting themselves out there, you probably do underestimate how far you can go putting yourselves out there before it actually becomes cringe, because everything feels unnatural in the beginning.
Yeah, I was going to say their cringe level is probably very, very low, like very super, low. Super low. So like doing anything that's a little bit unnatural will feel cringe to them, which I can understand. Yes. That's probably a thing that you almost have to get over. But I also don't like to think that's cringe. I think that's also just like confidence.
Yeah.
Because I also think it's going to sound nuts, but I think if you're sharing stuff online and sharing your face online, you have to be almost like delusionally confident in some ways. And it's hard to explain because like, it's hard to say that without sounding like an arrogant prick. It's just a fine line.
I mean, I'm trying to grow a podcast using LinkedIn as a channel with all of my high school and college connections. That's delusional.
Yeah.
I saw this thing on Twitter. I think it was actually yesterday. Jason Levin shared this screenshot of the artist Travis Scott back in 2013. And he was performing on this little town square stage to like 15 people. Yeah. And the caption was basically that, at this moment, someone from his high school for sure said, like, look at how cringe Travis is being. But you have to embrace it. You have to, like, get over yourself in those early days. And another quote that I wrote down of yours from your email, you said, get used to being cringe and nothing will scare you.
Yeah.
So maybe you could even, like, unpack that part of your journey, maybe in those earlier days where you hadn't yet built up this muscle and this confidence.
I think when I first started out, I was obviously worried about what other people said and thought naturally. And I'd say I was like that for quite a few years.
Yeah.
So when I was building my Twitter, Instagram, all these things, I would intentionally build it separately from like my profile that I had with friends. Like, for example, my Ultralinks branding, like, you know, that was like my branding away from my friends. My friends didn't know what I was doing day to day. Like, I wouldn't tell them. Because obviously, like, it's cringe. I'm just like, I'm starting out. Most people expect you to fail. And I actually don't think there's anything wrong with that. Because if you haven't done something, how can someone just suddenly expect you to do amazing at that thing? Like, that's not how it works. Because most people also do fail. Most people do. I probably shouldn't be saying that because that's probably not going to be very motivating for some people.
I would clarify by saying I think most people give up before they succeed.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. That's true. But yeah, when I think back, I think when I first was starting sharing stuff online, I was kind of just doing it in the background and I would let friends discover it. I'd let friends find it. I wouldn't intentionally tell them about what I'm doing. Because of that, I'd say actually in my first few years from like 18 to like 23, 24, I was very much just sort of like a hermit in a way. I was kind of staying at home, working away, hustling away, trying to figure stuff out. Those were very much my formative years when it comes to like my career and making money online. I think it was when I bought my house. I think it was when I bought my the house that I'm in right now. I think when I bought that, I was like, I've achieved something big here. I've achieved something massive. Why should I shy away from it? And then once other people, my friends, especially in family, had heard that, oh, you know, Ollie has bought a house. They're like, oh, how has he done that then? They're like, how's that happened? And then obviously they see what's happened, but it's not cringe anymore. Because instead they're telling me, wow, that's amazing. Well done. Like you've turned from something from nothing into something, like, you know, and it completely changed. And that's, I'd say, where like it changed. Once you have like some sort of success, doesn't have to be monetary, can be anything. Once you have some sort of success, people do change their tune and they do look at you differently. And they're like, oh, you know, what he's doing is actually pretty amazing. But it's so hard at the beginning. It's so hard to get past that bit. You've just got to find the success and then it will change.
Are you familiar with the everything is pointless graph?
I think so, yes. Yeah.
Jack Butcher has the everything is pointless graph. I'll link to it in the show notes. But I send everyone who wants to do anything in this world of just like building a brand, building an audience, even just putting themselves out there, doing anything that requires consistency, honestly, I send people that picture all the time because I think it's so representative of the journey where it's like you put in all these reps and it just feels like you're making no progress. And then all of a sudden it's like, boom, and it starts to happen and you start to see things compound and they start moving more quickly. And man, how many people, you know, give up just before that moment? But it's like none of this comes for free and none of it comes quickly or easily.
There's this study, isn't there, somewhere that I've seen numerous times about podcasts where, like, when it comes to podcasts, most podcasts fail because of whatever reason. But the podcasts, like, I think it's something like some stupid number of episodes, like 50 episodes or something, until like a podcast become like popular enough or succeeds or something like that. And you can imagine 50 podcasts, if you do one a week, that's nearly a year of work and you're not seeing any return. I can completely see why people would give up. Like, I completely get it. But yeah, like, it's just like, you should keep at it. You've got to be almost delusional that it's going to work. And a lot of people would give up too early. They're expecting results too quickly.
Hey guys, real quick, if you know me, then you know I love products. So I want to take just 30 seconds to tell you about three of my favorites. Now, anytime that I'm designing and building a website, you better believe that I'm going to use Framer. I made the switch recently and I'm never going back. Now, once it's time to animate my designs and showcase my work, that's when I'm going to use Jitter. It's like Figma, only for motion design. And every step of the way, I'm going to be using Raycast constantly. It's the cornerstone of how I use my computer and the way that I stay in flow while I work. Now, I hand-selected Framer, Raycast, and Jitter to partner with me so that I could do these interviews full-time. So if you want to show them some love, it would mean a lot. Okay, now on to the rest of the episode. Okay, I have a bunch of little things that I want to ask you, really just as a way to put ourselves in the shoes of someone who's kind of starting out, and we can kind of just jam on some advice.
Okay.
Does that sound good?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about social media strategies specifically, because if there's one thing that is constant about social media, it's change. Like, the playbook is always changing. What worked for me 3 years ago doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
How do you make sense of the current landscape for social media? And if you were just starting out, what would be some of the tactics or strategies that you would use to build momentum?
I think I'd focus on one social network first. And for me personally, that would be YouTube. Like, YouTube, when you think of all the social media networks that we've seen come and gone, YouTube has been the one that's been the most consistent. And it's like, isn't it like the second most visited website in the world or something?
Yep.
And the age range for YouTube is massive. Kids watch it, old people watch it. Like, I don't know anything like that. I don't know any other social network that's like that. So I think if I were to start from fresh again, it would very much be focusing on YouTube.
What about if you were looking at different opportunities to actually make money? Like, I'm a huge believer that everyone should have this experience where they make their first dollar on the internet. I remember mine deeply. even learning a little bit more about your journey, like it seems like you, beyond even like the Icon Packs, you had a real inflection point with Tumblr themes.
Yes.
Where you're making like tens of thousands of dollars a month on Tumblr themes. I think maybe you even had Justin Bieber using one of them.
Yeah, I did. Which is crazy. But
That's crazy. Obviously, in many ways, it's kind of irrelevant to designers today because that window is closed. Like, you can't make money making Tumblr themes anymore. So if you were starting out today, maybe you are getting some momentum on YouTube and you're thinking about the different ways that you might actually turn this into something that, like, you know, can help you provide for your family rather than just tinkering on the internet. What are some of the opportunities that you're seeing in today's landscape that designers could potentially use to break in and start building up that momentum?
I want to say Framer templates.
That was what came to mind for me too.
Like, for something that's similar to Tumblr, but I'm not sure Framer is still at that point yet where you can make, like, you know, 300,000 a year like I was doing with Tumblr.
I agree.
But that's because that's my baseline. So that's wrong. I shouldn't see that as my baseline. I think to myself, okay, what if you're trying to make $50,000 or $100,000 a year? Especially because obviously that probably is the goal for a lot of people who are just starting out.
Totally.
So I think to myself, yeah, Framer templates is a good place to start.
I've heard people talk about Wix Studio templates, even, like, that being the new marketplace. Ooh. I personally am not as interested. But if you are purely looking for the financial opportunity, yeah, maybe there's something there.
Yeah. But then I also think, like, I know from doing tech videos, obviously this isn't specifically designer related, but it could be. If you're making videos around maybe teaching design, or maybe you're sharing videos about you designing stuff, maybe sharing tutorials on how to make, say for example, off the top of my head, videos titled, I redesigned the linear website, or I designed the linear website in Figma, or I designed the linear website in Framer, something like that. You know, you're taking something popular there and sharing your process of designing that website. And the way I would see making money from that would either be sharing a template at the end of the video, being like, hey, if you want to get this, you could buy it for $50, $20, whatever. But you can also make money from a sponsorship in that video. Because sponsorships right now, especially for my channels, are like the biggest money makers. So I think as a designer, that's how you can make money. If you don't want to do client work specifically, you can sell your own templates, whether it's Framer, Webflow, Wix, whatever you want to sell them on. Or it could just be like a boiler template, HTML, CSS, whatever, basic. Or a Tailwind template, I don't know, anything. And then obviously you have sponsorships and stuff. Maybe you have a course as well, something like that. Trying to have different points where you can make money, I think, is quite important. Because I think having just one way of making money, you're cutting out a lot of potential customers.
Somebody that comes to mind is Dan Petty, who's done a good job of this, where he has like such a diversified portfolio of things. And like, I think I've paid him in multiple different ways. Like, I still even have like a marker pack that he made probably 5 or 6 years ago at this point, where I bought it and I use it all the time. So like, I like your example of kind of giving the behind the scenes on YouTube, but then maybe offering like the actual assets themselves for some kind of like a small price, or maybe even just as a way to like start building up an email list. If you don't even know what your opportunity is in the future, but you know that you want to keep contributing towards building up this kind of audience.
Yeah. I think Dan Petty is a very good example of someone who's like, he's actually done the work. Like, he spent years making these amazing websites for some amazing clients. He's not just some random person who's come along and just sort of just started acting like, you know, he's like this special designer. Like, Dan actually has the evidence to back it up. But what Dan is doing is very, very smart, where like, he's diversified, he's built this personal brand, and like, you go on his website, it looks awesome. Like, I think he's another good example of someone who has an aesthetic. He has this very specific aesthetic that he applies to everything. Because like, you look at his studio in his videos and it's so different from mine. Like, it's completely so different. But we're still technically sort of doing the same thing. We're in front of camera, we're talking, but we have our own aesthetic and we have our own way of doing things. And I think that is a great example of someone who's like developed their own style and is doing things the way they want to do them.
Let's talk about more of the, like, the relationship building side. Because obviously, you know, you've seen a lot of success on these social channels, but you also have like really meaningful connections that you've been able to make. You mentioned Ali Abdaal. I know he actually just slid into your Twitter DMs. Like, how cool is that, right? Yeah. And I know you're at the point now where like a lot of that is inbound, but maybe we could speak to a designer who is feeling a little bit on the sidelines right now. Maybe they don't live in a tech hub. They don't feel like they have some kind of like a meaningful network. Maybe they're the only designer at their company even. Yeah. We've talked about the value of kindness, but are there other things that you think designers can be doing in terms of how they can use the internet to build meaningful connections with people in the industry?
So I think they would need to start first by sharing work regularly. Okay. I naturally trust people who are sharing work constantly, like online, sharing opinions.
Why do you think that is?
I think because, you know, when someone messages me on Twitter or Instagram, I go to their profile and I very much do judge them on like what they're posting, what they're mm-hmm. sharing. So I think trying to have like a clean, likable personality online before you even start messaging people is probably very important. You're more likely to get a response back, which is a shame when you also think about it, because we're very much judging people based on like their follower count, what they're sharing and stuff like that. But that's what status and like social cues are, right? Like you very much do judge someone on what they're wearing, how they're dressed, the way they do their hair, the way they look, what car they're driving, all these different things, you know. I think social media applies the same. So I think if you're a designer who's just starting out and is feeling lost a little bit, you've got to have something showing that you're serious about this. Like you're serious about being like a designer. You're serious about taking this to the next level. You're serious about getting advice. I had a designer from Linear message me about personal branding. I'm not going to say who he is, but he messaged me about personal branding. Like he specifically messaged me about that. He even subscribed to my premium Twitter account, hoping that he could get more stuff about premium branding. And I asked him, hey, why did you subscribe? And the only reason I asked him that was because I could see he had the work there. He was sharing work and he was already doing stuff. He was trying to learn. So I know that I'm more likely to reply to someone. I'm more likely to help someone out when I know they're taking it seriously. And they're not kind of just like dilly-dallying in a way, you could say, kind of just trying to figure out what they want to do.
I actually took a course on this like years ago, which seems silly, but it was one of the most valuable courses I've ever taken.
A course on relationship building.
It was on audience building. It was by Sahil Bloom. It was one of the first really popular Maven courses. The alumni from this course is nuts. Like it's really, really interesting. Unfortunately, it's not a course anymore. It was like this little moment in time.
Yes.
And one of the things that I came out of that course with was this mental model of viewing your profile on Twitter as a product in itself. Like if we're a designer, your tagline is like the hero copy of a landing page. Your cover photo is whatever the graphic is in that hero section. If you think about like your pinned tweet even, it's like, what is your onboarding flow? Because this is like your first taste of the product itself. And then really making sure that like whatever the first, at all times, like having the top of your feed, having something meaningful, something that would be interesting to your target market and like the, or the type of people that you are hoping to attract. And that level of like intentionality was not something that I was doing previously. And it's something that I have taken, you know, quite seriously over the last few years. And I think it speaks to what you're talking about, where it's like, you are designing the initial impression of your account in the same way that you would be designing the initial impression of a product or a landing page.
Yeah, I think I do exactly the same without even thinking about it. Like if you go to my Twitter profile, you look at my Twitter profile and you look at my tweets, I'm very intentional about the tweets I leave up because I delete a lot of tweets quite regularly just because there'll be spur of the moment sort of thoughts. And then I realize, oh, actually, I'm not sure if I want this to be up there permanently. I have to be so intentional about what people see because I am the one telling the story here. And I have to make sure that the story I tell is the way I want it to be told. This is also why I'm very picky about podcasts I go on as well, because I want to make sure it sort of aligns, I guess, with who I am and what I do and what I want to share. Because obviously here we are doing this podcast, like people who follow me or random people on the internet who don't follow me will come across this and this will be their first impression.
Yeah.
And I have to think about that. That's why I also hope that the first impression I give not necessarily has to be nice. I don't actually care too much about being like super nice or like super friendly, but like respected is maybe the right word. Like, I want people to respect that we can have different opinions. We can have different thoughts, different lifestyles, and that's completely okay. Like, it'd be weird if we were all the same and we all agreed on the same things. But I think respected is probably the word I'm looking for most.
Let's talk about how you visualize that then, because you talked about your personal site. I've heard you say that you've like redesigned this thing like 30 plus times.
Oh, yeah, I have no idea.
Which in itself is a little bit insane, but yeah. Maybe we could talk about how your personal aesthetic and narrative has evolved over time as you're going through those iterations, learning what works and exploring even how you want to portray yourself.
When I think about all of my versions of my personal website, they were all very minimal, very, very minimal. White background, black and gray text. It's always kind of been like that. I like my work and what I'm doing to do the talking. So I want people to click through to my other things that I do. Because I do so many different things, right? There isn't just one single thing that I do. And because of that, I actually don't want my personal website to be overly fancy. I just want people to quickly go in there, quickly read whatever they need to read, and then link to other corners of the internet that I have. So like now I'd say, you know, my personal website is like, yeah, like it's pretty basic, and I've always tried to keep it like that and just let my other stuff do the talking as much as possible.
What about for other designers who maybe don't have this robust portfolio of things that they're doing? Mm-hmm. You know, they have like maybe a couple past roles. They have some solid work that comes out of that. Obviously, like the skills and the work is important, but like how you tell that story about yourself is very important too. Mm-hmm. And in my conversations with designers, I'm definitely feeling this general sentiment where there's like a pressure to stand out, especially with AI. Like everyone kind of wants to be unique in some way. So how do you think designers can figure out what their own unique value proposition is and how to tell that narrative about themselves?
I think as a designer, there are a few things that can make you unique. What you work on, of course, is probably one of the biggest. A designer who works on app design probably isn't going to be the same designer who works on like a website design. Even a website design, like a designer who designs blogs is going to be very different from a designer who designs financial banking systems. So trying to figure out what type of designer you are, first of all. And then I think the second thing is the aesthetic, trying to figure out what your style is. For example, when we think of famous designers, we think of their aesthetic. We think of like Picasso, we think of like Van Gogh, we think of Dieter Rams. They have a specific style. You know them for that style. And I think about designers now who are the same. I think about, there is a Turkish designer. I forgot his name because
Ogurs.
His aesthetic is so unique.
So unique.
And like, that is his unique selling point. It's the same with James McDonald. Yeah. He has this very unique aesthetic where we're like, when I see a website designed by him, I know it's him without even having to sort of like look at who's designed the website. Same with, is his name Ogurs, did you say?
Ogurs, yeah.
Yeah, same with him. Like when I see a website and I'm like, yeah, I know that was designed by him. Same. I think that can be another unique selling point. And I'd actually say like those two things together, figuring out what type of designer you are and then your aesthetic, are probably the main two things you need, because that's what I've been hired for in the past. They've seen something that I've done similar to what they've done. And then they've also seen my aesthetic, so they want that aesthetic. So those two things together come to a point, and that is what they hire me for. And I think designers can do exactly the same with their websites, with their portfolios, with their Twitter, Instagram, whatever.
What about for designers who maybe are a little bit earlier in their career where they feel like they're still figuring out their aesthetic? Mm. I'm going to talk about a very specific email that I received actually this last week. Somebody emailed me and they are a third generation organic farmer in Idaho, and they're trying to transition into just web and design and this entire digital world that for generations has been foreign to the family, right? And the question was basically like, how should I structure and sequence a self-taught learning journey? What are the things that matter? And what advice do you have about like the order that I should even go about learning these things? And it's a very tough question, but as someone that, you know, went to school for accounting, you kind of had to figure
some of this out. They weren't teaching you like typography and spacing right after managerial accounting. So maybe you could share a little bit about what that journey looked like for you and what advice you have for others that are feeling like they're kind of close to the starting line today and want to strategically chart out their own learning journey.
This is a question I get as well. Exactly the same type of question. People ask me, if you were to do it all again, what would you do? Or like, how did your process work? Like, is there a structure? And I'll be honest, it was an absolute mess. Like when I think back to like how I started and what I did, there was no structure. There was no plan. And unfortunately, I think people feel like that before they start something, they need a plan. But I really don't think that's how it works. For me anyway, nothing has ever gone to plan, ever. There is no structure. So I don't think they should be too hung up on that, on trying to figure out like, okay, what's the next step? What do I need to learn next? What do I need to do next? Stuff like that. You've just got to do it. You've just got to start making stuff. You'll learn along the way. You'll fill in the gaps along the way. If you're eager enough to learn, you will fill in the gaps along the way. Like people ask me, oh, you know, what design courses did you take to become a designer? I'm like, I didn't take any design courses. I didn't take a single thing. My design course was Dribbble. I'd go on Dribbble. I see what people have made. I'd be like, can I replicate that? Let's try it. And then I'll just go in Photoshop at the time or Sketch at the time before Figma. And I'd be trying to copy it, trying to be like, oh, okay, that's how they did that. That's how they did this. That's how I expanded my design skills. There is no structure. There is no formula. And that's completely okay. I think more people need to get used to the idea. Like, you will just learn as you go along. There doesn't have to be a structure.
What about zooming ahead to today? Because you talk a lot about the importance of learning. What's something that you are learning now?
Something I'm actually trying to learn is making an app, making an iOS app.
Cool.
It's something I just wanted to do for fun because I wanted to start very basic. Was make like a wallpaper app. Super simple. I have wallpapers. Stuff like, how cool would it be to make like an AI generating wallpaper app? There are others out there. Like, there's no doubt there are other AI generating wallpapers out there. But I think to myself, oh, it'd be cool to learn how to do this. And I'd also like to use AI to build it. I'd like to use like, I don't even know what I would use, but like, even I was experimenting with ChatGPT the other day, and ChatGPT was giving me all this code, spitting out all this code. And I was like, whoa, okay. This might be easier than I expected because I don't have to write all the code myself. And it was even telling me step by step, like open up Xcode, new project, all this sort of stuff. And I was like, man, we have so much opportunity now to like learn whatever we want to learn. That is like easier than ever.
Do you know Gabe Valdivia by chance?
No.
Okay, so Gabe approached me at Config and he just kind of put his phone in front of me. He's like, look at this. He has no coding background at all, but he built this really cool iOS app called Almanac, and he did it entirely with Cursor. I don't know if you've seen, have you seen Cursor yet?
Cursor, let's have a look.
This is your path, I think, to shipping your iOS app, because it's amazing. It has like integrated AI within the IDE, and someone like Gabe built a killer iOS app without having any coding background. And now he's working on his second app. And so I look at him and I'm just like, oh my gosh, I have no excuse. Like, I have to do this because I'm in the same boat. Like, that is something that I want to do. It's been multiple years since I've designed a mobile app, but I want to actually build it this time.
Is it cursor.com?
I think it might be cursor.ai.
Because I have cursor.com and it says the AI code editor.
Oh, that's it then. Wow, they got the .com. Yep, this is it, cursor.com.
Okay. Damn, that domain must have been pricey.
I just assumed it would be .ai because it's a startup.
Yeah, I think like you just said, like he's not a developer or anything. He's kind of just like...
just a designer.
And he's come up with an app. And like you said...
and
like,
it's good.
The opportunity now to make stuff, it's just insane. Like, you can really make anything you want. And that's what blows my mind. And it kind of makes me think like, should I try other things? Because... something I've shared on my channels and stuff in the past is that obviously I don't want to be doing YouTube forever. I don't want to be sitting in front of a camera forever. I want to be able to at some point have everything leveraged where like everything just sort of ticks over and I have other people working on it or I have AI working for me or something like that. And I think to myself, oh, you know, doing stuff like this might be like the path, but I don't know what that is yet. I don't know what my next step is after YouTube or anything. I haven't figured that out yet.
Well, I know one of the steps that you do kind of have fleshed out is you're working on a course, or maybe two courses even, for people who are listening to this that want to go a little bit deeper. So before I let you go, can you share a little bit more about what your plan is there and maybe like even what designers or people who are interested in this can expect to get out of it?
I've been experimenting with courses for a while, and it wasn't something that I wanted to do. I kind of always thought courses were a bit like scammy, a bit like this, that, and the other. But then I sort of realized, actually, courses can be such a good way to just compact a lot of information into one place, like information that you know into one place. So obviously, I have the video creator course, which I released like last year. It's not totally relevant now to like this podcast, I'd say, but I think the two courses I have right now that are more relevant to this podcast specifically is I'm doing Build Your Personal Brand with Maven. We have a course on there, and that is like a live course directly communicating with students, trying to figure out and sort of help them build their own personal brand, share my experience of building a personal brand. We also have a new course coming out called onlinecreatorcourse.com. And the whole idea is trying to make money online as a creator, whatever type of creator you are, and me sharing what I've done, what I would do if I were to start again, and sharing resources, especially like resources, numbers, figures and revenue figures and like products that I've not shared anywhere else. Like people don't know specific numbers on like products and stuff and how I make them. Everything, all of that sort of information is in this course. So stuff literally you ain't seen anywhere else. Main reason why I haven't shared it anywhere else is because like it hasn't really made sense to. But I think in a course like this where I can go into detail, online creator course, like it's going to be like our sort of next big thing, you could say, in a way, because even though we're doing online creators, we're also trying to share like wealth building, investing, anything to do with being an online creator, basically.
Well, very excited about that. I know for me personally, like I'm probably, I don't know, 5-ish years into this journey. It's been the best investment that I've ever made for my career. And it only increases its value every year. And so for anyone who's like kind of listening and they're just like, you know, this, it feels scary, but also I can see the value in it. Like it's just, not only is it very, very fun, but man, it's just, it's such a good investment no matter what you're trying to do. Even if it is just trying to land your next W-2 role. Like,
yeah. It's just so scalable, isn't it? I think that's the thing. Like it's so scalable. You're not limited to like a salary. There is like an infinite amount you can make technically. It's just how much work you're willing to put in, what product you come up with, what you're sharing, what you're making, whatever it might be. And that's such a good feeling because like your output is like, you can leverage your output. You can leverage so many different things, which you couldn't do with like a lot of other things, like especially like client work and things like that.
Well, Alia, thank you for coming on and giving us a little bit of a behind the scenes into your journey and what you're thinking about. It's been really, really inspiring for me, and I know for other people listening. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me as well. Yeah, this has been a lot of fun.
Hey, it's Rid. Don't forget, if you want to go even deeper, each week I send an email out to over 10,000 designers with bonus resources and key takeaways from these conversations. So head to dive.club/email to sign up. Okay, I'll see you next week.